Well, good morning, everyone. Clive Staples Lewis, better known as C.S. Lewis. You probably have heard this name before. Who has read the Narnia series, or at least heard of it? Okay, a few. All right, so today we're going to look at the life story of this man, and for this, we're going to travel back to the turn of the 20th century. So we start in Belfast, in Northern Ireland. And this is where C.S. Lewis was born, or Clive Staples, as his name was. He was the second son to Albert and Florence, both very highly educated people. Albert was a solicitor, Florence was a mathematician. Their first son was called Warnie, or Warren was his full name, but he was always known as Warnie. Now, at the age of four, Clive Staples decided that he didn't deserve such an awful name. He wanted to be called Jaxy, and that was after a neighbourhood dog that had recently been run over. And so he was so determined about this that he wouldn't respond to anything else other than Jaxy. And so soon his family had to call him Jaxy, which became Jack, and then all his friends throughout all his life knew him just as Jack. Nobody ever called him Clive Staples. And so from this point on, I will be calling him Jack Lewis as well. Now, Jack was born into a Protestant family, but the family wasn't particularly religious. Warnie and Jack had a very, like, idyllic childhood. They lived in a beautiful place with a lot of land. They were able to explore. They had woods nearby and so on. But their favourite thing was actually writing and creating imaginary lands. In fact, Jack, he created this land called Animal Land, where he had talking animals, little mice in chainmail, fighting cats and all sorts of other things. His brother also created stories with steam trains and machinery. When he was a little bit older, they moved to a place called Little Lee, a lovely house which reflected that Albert was doing quite well as a solicitor. And this larger house was full of corridors and rooms to explore. And every single room in that house was jam-packed full of books. There were bookcases everywhere. And Jack loved to read. He had an insatiable appetite for books. And here, too, was a wonderful experience of childhood. They spent seaside holidays together, playing. They had the woods nearby. There were gardens. It really was a perfect childhood. But even though he had such a sort of idyllic childhood, he had a very deep sense of longing. He termed this as joy with a capital J. He wanted to find it. Even as a young child, he glimpsed it just momentarily, sometimes just in looking out the window to see the distant hills, or maybe even in the beauty of a flower. He recognized that there was this unsatisfied desire in him, and occasionally he would get this moment of sheer exuberant happiness, something quite deep, but then it would be gone. So in his life, even from a young age, he wanted to pursue this joy, as he termed it. And this certainly became a bit of a theme in his life. Now, one night when Jack was just 9 years old, he had a terrible toothache and he cried out to his mother. He was crying out, calling her, but she never came. He didn't really understand why. He kept crying and calling. But then in the middle of the night, his father burst into his room in tears and declared that his mother was really sick with cancer. Now, Jack was terrified. He didn't really understand what was going on. But from that day, there were strange people coming in and out of the house, carrying horrible-looking needles and implements, and they were told to be quiet and keep away. In fact, his mother had very advanced cancer, and they actually had to perform surgery in the house. And you can imagine that would have been horrifying for two young boys to watch at a distance. Jack and Warnie were very much distanced, not only from their mother, who was now under morphine and bedridden, but also from their father, who didn't want to have anything to do with them. He was so focused on his wife. Now, during this time, Jack remembered something he'd been taught before at church, that if you prayed fervently enough, then, and if you had enough willpower in your prayer, then God would grant whatever you ask. And so that's what he decided to do. He was going to pray. He was going to pray for the healing of his mother. And so very devoutly and with true belief and sheer willpower, he prayed for the healing of his mother. Now, at this point, he viewed God as a bit of a magician. You know, if you asked well enough, then he would grant you whatever you wanted and then disappear again. Well, their mum continued to be in considerable pain, and the surgery did nothing to halt the cancer, which was now rampant through her body. And she died soon after. Now, you might think that Jack would have been crushed by this, but he wasn't. He wasn't really that disappointed, because he was used to things not working, and he just thought that this was just something else that hadn't worked out. You see, to God, for him, at this point, God was not a person. He was not some sort of judge or someone to love or to respect. He was simply a magician, and the magician hadn't come. Now, the children certainly struggled with grief. But for Albert, the father, this was a really difficult time. Now, the children had actually felt that they'd lost their mother a lot earlier, ever since she was sick almost, because they had to keep away. They couldn't go in and see her. And then she was bedridden and sort of always sleepy under the morphine. So they felt like she'd gone way before she'd actually died. But for Albert, it was very difficult. And for him, actually, the loss of his wife also lost him his two sons. He became very emotional, very angry. He spoke to them really irrationally and unjustly, and he had flares of temper. And then other times he would want them near him. And the two boys found him very difficult as a father at this point. Now, Warnie and Jack had to learn to rely on each other, just to make life bearable. And Jack wrote, "With my mother's death, all settled happiness, all that was tranquil and reliable, disappeared from my life. There was to be much fun, many pleasures, many stabs of joy, but no more the old security. It was sea and islands now. The great continent had sunk like Atlantis." Perhaps out of necessity, Albert packed his youngest son, Jack, off to boarding school 2 weeks after his mother's death. He was to go to a prep school in England, which was quite a distance away. Now, Warnie was already at this school. It was a school that they had chosen. But Albert decided that it was time for Jack to also go off to prep school. So it's hard to imagine, but actually the two boys were sent by themselves on a steamship and then a train all the way to England to go to a boarding school where they would stay for months on end before they would see their father again. Now, why Albert picked this particular school is a bit of a mystery. Perhaps he didn't really know it very well or know what was going on. Jack certainly had no idea what to expect at this particular school. And the reason was because Warnie never, ever talked about school when it was holiday time and when he came back for the school holidays. And Jack soon realised why Warnie never said a word about school. This school only had about 20 pupils altogether. It was a place that was on the brink of closure. The dormitories were freezing cold. There were no curtains in the windows. They were only allowed a bath once a week. The food was very inadequate. There simply wasn't enough of it. But the worst thing was the headmaster. Jack nicknamed him Oldie, and he was a tyrant. And Jack describes the deathly silence in the classroom as Oldie would take a run-up at a kid to beat him. And sometimes the only crime this particular kid had done was to be the son of a dentist, which, according to the headmaster, was a low-class, low-status position. And this particular boy used to be determined to be absolutely silent during the beating. Jack remembers a time when he couldn't take it anymore, and the poor boy let out this horrible gurgling cry of pain. And Jack had that sound in his head for years. Now, Jack had already been taught at home by his mother and a governess, so his time at this particular prep school literally added nothing to his education. They lived in fear of this tyrant principal who was so unpredictable with his fits of rage and just grabbing kids and beating them and all sorts of things. So in fact, they learned how to survive, and Warnie had learned as well. They worked out that you could do the same sums every day on your slate. You see, you were beaten if you didn't do the sums, but nobody actually checked what sums you were doing. So they ended up doing the same sums day after day, and nobody actually knew that they weren't learning a thing. So his time at this school was characterized by fear and endless, meaningless arithmetic. The school actually folded 2 years later, and actually Oldie, the headmaster, was declared insane and was sent to an asylum. One good effect of this school was that every Sunday they had to go to a local church, and Jack was impressed that the people who were actually there at the church, who were talking and so on, seemed to actually believe what they were talking about. It was the first time he'd seen that. And so he started trying to pray and read his Bible, very much out of duty, and he saw religion as something that was very serious and very severe. Now, when they went home for the school holidays, Jack and Warnie's relationship with their father, it was not good. Their father was very distant from them, and he was still struggling with grief, and he buried himself in his work as a solicitor. And his emotions were as volatile as ever. They actually were relieved when he went to work for the 10 hours every day, and they had the house to themselves, and they would steel themselves for when he had to return in the evening. Now, actually, Jack went to many schools during his childhood. He moved around quite a lot. And each school had a particular impact on his later life. After the horrors of this particular boarding school that we mentioned, which folded in 2 years, he went to another school, kind of like another sort of prep school. He was almost a teenager at this point. And again, these were boarding schools. He only ever went to boarding schools. And for this particular school, it was very clear early on that he was gifted. He was an extremely good writer. He could pick up languages very quickly. But there was a particular matron at the school, and that was like a lady whose job was to look after all the boarders. And she kind of acted as a mother to all the boys, the young boys. And because I think Jack had lost his mother, he really connected with this lady. But she also talked a lot about spiritual things, and this had a huge influence on Jack. But her interest in spiritual things was actually in Satanism and the occult. That's where her interest lay. And this had a huge impact on Jack. And he started to move further and further away from Christianity. Then he went to another school. This school was called Malvern. Warnie was already there, being a little bit older than him. And Warnie loved this school and was so excited that finally Jack would reach his high school years and join him there. But for Jack, this school was a nightmare of a very different kind. The nightmare came not from the teachers at all, but from the students. In fact, the teachers recognized Jack's brilliance pretty quickly, and they accelerated him in all his classes. They gave him extra work. They really pushed and challenged him. But for the students, being an excellent scholar at classical Greek and Latin and being terrible at sport and hopeless at team games meant that he was a big target. There was also a bit of a hierarchy here at this school. The prefects, or like the year 12s, I guess you could say, they had a lot of power, particularly because, you remember, these are boarding schools. And they could pick on the younger kids and make them do exactly what they wanted them to do. And Jack was one of the ones that they picked on. And so his life was a misery. He was constantly dragged by, you know, this prefect or that prefect to do their dirty work. He had to clean their boots and do all sorts of other dirty things for them, like whatever they didn't want to do, he had to do. And then this meant that he had no time for study. He was often late for class, and then he got into trouble, but he couldn't say anything because he was, you know, these guys would beat him up if he'd mentioned anything. He was in constant misery because he hated compulsory sport. He hated team games, and all of this had to be done at the school. He couldn't stand rugby. To him, it was all pointless waste of time. And he was so tired because at every point, you know, whether he had work to do or he was made to do this, that, and the other for all these prefects, he just had no time to rest at all. And he lived in constant stress of being bullied and pulled in one direction or the other. It was actually enough to break anybody. And at this point in his life, he lost a lot of that sense of joy that he had from childhood. And he became really pessimistic about the universe. And he thought, why should there be a God? What sort of God would create a world such as this? Now, it did become too much for him, and he begged his father in letters, letter after letter, to please take him out of this school. He was getting bullied terribly. He was he called himself dog-tired. All he dreamt of was sleeping. That's what he wanted. And their father, well, Jack's father, didn't listen at all. In fact, that was a common thing. He never listened to his boys. He never took anything into account when they told him things. And it was only his opinion that really mattered. And so despite all these letters, the father did nothing. But, and this was perhaps a blessing from God, Warnie was not doing well at school. And his father was very shocked at this. He thought that Warnie was doing great, but it came to his attention that Warnie was actually at risk of failing his final exams to go into a military college. And the father, Albert, was so angry at this and he couldn't believe it. He thought, what? My son is failing? I thought he was doing really well. What sort of school is this? What sort of school has had this terrible quality of teaching? And he decided to pull Warnie out of the school. He sent Warnie to a private sort of tutor, a professor that he'd known, Professor Kirkpatrick. And Warnie had a year to catch up, and he did, and he passed his final exams well. And then Albert thought, I don't want that to happen to my younger son. Maybe I will have to pull him out too. And so he called Jack and he said, I'm thinking I should probably pull you out of this school, Malvin. It hasn't served your older brother well. But if I send you to this Professor Kirkpatrick for private tuition, it'll be a very dull life for you. You know, that there will be no compulsory sport. You won't be doing any team games, and there won't be any of your friends. You won't have any boys to play with. You'll be just living with this older couple, and you'll be just there with them. It'll be a very dull existence in the country. Well, the more Jack listened to this, the more he thought that he was describing heaven. It was heaven compared to where he was at Malvern. He tried not to look too excited, and he said to his father that he thought he could manage. Now, Professor Kirkpatrick was the next big influence on Jack. Now, this professor was very close to a pure logical entity. He would never let anyone get away with just sort of meaningless small talk and things like that. In fact, Jack found this out the moment he stepped out of the station and met this particular professor. He was trying to make polite conversation, you know, he'd been taught this as a good English schoolboy, and he just remarked casually, oh, I was quite surprised at the scenery of Surrey. It's a lot wilder than I expected. And the professor said, stop! On what grounds did you have for expecting something wilder? And what exactly is your definition of wildness? Well, Jack really had nothing to say. He didn't really understand what was going on. But the professor said, you know, I'm not making fun. What do you know of the geography of Surrey and the flora here? What grounds are you making this comment? And soon Jack had to admit that he just made the comment. And the professor replied, well, don't you see? Your comment was completely meaningless. Well, some people would have found this a little hard to manage, but for Jack, he loved the challenge that everything he said had to have meaning. And he soon came to really love the purely rational, logical thought. And he respected this professor. And soon, he was also thinking in the same way. Now, Kirkpatrick, this professor, was an atheist. And he was an atheist because he felt it was the way, a rational way of viewing the universe. And so, Jack embraced this thinking. And he did away with any remaining scrap of religion that he had left. And perhaps it's a bit of an irony, because it was his training here under Professor Kirkpatrick, this training in logical thinking, in rational thought, that actually enabled Jack to become one of the great Christian writers of our century. His highly rational approach has actually helped a lot of people grasp many spiritual truths. So, in a way, even now as an atheist, the Lord was using this period of his life to train him for later things. The incredible rigor of the teaching and training under Professor Kirkpatrick for the last 2 years of his schooling led to two things. Firstly, Jack was no longer the snob that he was before in his early school years, where he thought that he was the smartest. He'd really been put in his place by this professor. And although he was brilliant and gifted, he now didn't feel he was. And the second thing was that he was brilliant and gifted, and so he passed his exams to get into the University of Oxford very easily. And he did so well, although actually, after finishing the exam, he told the professor he'd failed miserably, and that's how he felt. And he was invited to become a scholar at the University College in Oxford. Now, we didn't know this at the time, but Kirkpatrick had actually written a letter to Albert, Jack's father. And he wrote in this letter, you may make a writer or a scholar of him, but you won't make of him anything else. And actually, Jack knew that this was true. He knew that he was kind of destined to be some sort of academic or some sort of writer. But this was a game that very few people won and a lot of people lost. And it kind of terrified him. In April, the train pulled into Oxford for the start of the academic year. And a wide-eyed Jack hopped off that train so excited to finally be in the city of education, the city of learning, with its great towers and the white spires, the wonderful ancient place that Oxford was. Well, he walked briskly out of the station, and he passed some pretty ordinary-looking flats and then some pretty ordinary-looking shops. Everything looked very boring and drab, and he wondered where the towers were and all those white spires everyone was talking about and the great ancient buildings. It was looking very ordinary, but he kept thinking to himself, just around the next corner, maybe on the next rise, maybe I'll see it over the next hill. He kept walking for ages, and finally he hit the countryside, and he realized, of course, that he'd gone in completely the wrong direction. So he turned around and retraced his steps, and just as he was retracing his steps, he came to a rise, and he looked, and there was the whole city of Oxford, which had been behind him the whole time. Later, he would see this little incident as an allegory of his entire life. The year was now 1917, and if you know your history, you'll know that this was when Europe was plunged into war. Jack already knew that he would be enlisted soon. He was 18, and so he knew that he was going to have to start training and he would be a soldier. He didn't relish this thought. His brother was in the military, but he himself, he wasn't keen about this at all. And he said that the war could have his body, but it couldn't have his mind. And so he refused to think about it until he had to.
Now,
during his officer training, he became friends with a man by the name of Paddy Moore. They were roommates as they were training to be soldiers. And they vowed to each other that if one of them died in the war, then the other would look after the remaining parent. Now, both Jack and Paddy, they only had one parent left. For Paddy, his father had died, and of course for Jack, his mother had died. Now, Jack didn't talk much about his war experience, but he did write a little bit, and this gives us a glimpse into what he endured. He was sent to France, to the front lines, to the trenches, and he remembered the icy water seeping through boots that you could never take off. He remembered the freezing cold and lying in mud, your flesh being torn by barbed wire. He remembered marching and actually being asleep while marching. And he remembers the men lying dead like half-crushed beetles, some even sitting propped up in death, so you didn't know that they were dead. But he also remembered some of the good things. He remembered that, you know, in their regiment, they were a very mixed group. There were Oxford students, barristers, high professionals who were called into service. There were also farmers, all these people mixed together. He said the conversation was excellent and they really cared and looked after each other. None of them really wanted to be there. Now, during this war, Jack was hit by a piece of shrapnel which came off a shell. The shell actually killed one of the officers in his regiment. And with his significant injuries, he was taken to an army hospital. There, from the hospital and with significant injuries, he wrote to his father and he pleaded with his father to come and visit him. He was actually quite scared. He was still quite young at this time and he really missed home. He'd seen a whole lot of horrors in war that he rarely wanted to talk about. He'd seen so much death and he just wanted to see his family again. Warnie was still in service. And so it was just his father. And even though their relationship wasn't good, he just wanted to see his dad. But Albert was a man who valued his work even above his own child. And he never came. In fact, his father didn't even come to see him off to the war when he was called up and he was sent to France. He'd sent a message to his father, but his father couldn't make it that day, even though he probably would have been well aware that that may have been the last time he would see his son. During his time recuperating in this army hospital, he found out that his friend Paddy Moore had been killed. And so he decided that he would indeed follow up on that vow that he'd made, and he would find Paddy Moore's mother and care for her. Paddy also had a younger sister called Maureen, who was still a child at that time. When Jack finally returned to Oxford, it was to a very battered and grieving place, country. Many of his brilliant peers and all those students who had enrolled with him were now dead. And in fact, the porter who was at the gate when Jack walked in congratulated him on being alive. He studied philosophy and he did very, very well. He received two firsts, which is quite an unusual thing to receive two firsts in this particular subject. But even though he was so qualified, he couldn't get any work. There was no teaching positions going. So he decided to continue studying and he picked up English, thinking that maybe he would be able to have more work that way. And he did the English course, which was normally a 2, maybe 3 year course. He did it in 1 year and he received a first there too. So with 3 firsts, this is highly unusual. In fact, I don't know if anyone else has actually achieved that. With 3 firsts, you would think he would be able to get work. But no, it was very hard to find any work. Now, around this time, he had already met Mrs. Moore. He had also, he actually combined his money with hers to support her, and they actually found a home together with himself, Mrs. Moore, and her daughter Maureen. And during this time, because he had a very little allowance, he pretty much lived in poverty. And he was also supporting her and the daughter. And they had to live such a simple and frugal life. And this lifestyle actually never left him. He, even though later on he was a lot more successful, he still lived in this very simple way. Now, life with Mrs. Moore was actually really difficult. She did support him emotionally because, you know, she was nurturing as a mother. And in fact, Lewis ended up calling her mother. But she was also quite demanding. And in fact, people around Jack kind of thought, you know, she's way too demanding on you. You don't need to do this for her. But actually, Jack did. He did all the domestic things she wanted him to do. He was the one about the house who had to fix everything, to clean, to do all of those domestic things. And he actually felt later on that this was a very important thing in his life. It kept him down to earth. It kept him humble. Because later, no matter how much he was praised as a gifted writer, the best debater Britain had seen, a great conversationalist and speaker, all of those things that were heaped upon him, all that praise, well, he would have to come home and carry a sack of potatoes up the stairs or clean out a fireplace. And that really kept him down to earth. And also, later on, he reflected that he was able to understand what the average person did. And had he not had this experience, he would have lived in his imagination and just kind of lived in his books and had no idea about how average people live their daily lives. It was now 1925 and Jack Lewis was 27 years old. And finally, he was appointed a fellow at Magdalen College in Oxford. His father cried when he received this news. It was finally a secure job. He would be an Oxford Don, as they're called. So here he was now full, his life was now full of lecturing. He tutored individual students. But because he was teaching philosophy, he really had to think about things. He had to think about what he really understood, what he really thought about the world. And that profound longing, that joy with a capital J, hadn't left him. And he wanted to understand what this was. He wanted to grasp it because in it he saw something of the meaning of what life was all about. But during this time, he certainly wouldn't have thought about God. But unfortunately for him, well, he kept stumbling across Christian things. So, for example, when he was at a station one day and waiting for a train, he went into a bookshop and he randomly picked up a book. Now, he'd read so much that there were very few books he hadn't read. And so he found a book he hadn't read and he bought it and he started reading. It was George MacDonald's Fantasties. Now, George MacDonald is a Christian. He's a Christian writer. And this particular book was not an overtly Christian book, but it was an allegory. And as he read this book, he glimpsed something of holiness, something he hadn't really thought about before. And then on top of that, he also read other books by G.K. Chesterton and the poetry of George Herbert and John Donne. All these people were people who'd become Christians and they were writing from a Christian worldview. And Lewis actually really appreciated their writing and it sort of opened his mind to different thinking. And then in 1926, he was having a nice conversation with a fellow atheist. This atheist was another academic. And this man just offhandedly remarked, "Rum thing, all that stuff about a dying God. It almost looks as if it had happened." And went on to talk about how the history of the Gospels had to be true. And that, well, you couldn't really just dismiss Jesus because in history there was a Jesus. You couldn't just say that he didn't exist. Well, this really shook Lewis because he wasn't comfortable with his position. He wanted just to sweep Jesus aside and just say that, you know, he didn't exist and nothing was true. But he couldn't because he'd been trained under Professor Kirkpatrick to be logical and rational, to have consistency of thought. And he recognized in himself that he knew something was true, but he just didn't want to accept it. Now, if you'd talked to Jack at this point, he would have said that he was a materialist. He only believed in things that he could see. And he believed that all other religions were simply mythologies made up by humans for humans. But for him, God was definitely on the move. Because even as he was very clear verbally about his stance as an atheist and a materialist and all of that, he was influenced a lot during this period by different things. Obviously, the writings of these Christian authors, but also the newfound friends that he made at Oxford. Many of them were also, later on, as he discovered, Christians. He felt like he was being attacked from all sides. And he felt, even in the quiet moments, the steady approach of God. And no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't ignore that there was a God in the universe. He saw clearly in himself that he didn't want there to be a God. He actually referred to God at this point as the great interferer, someone who just interferes with your life. And he didn't want a God to be in control of his life, to tell him what to do. He wanted to live his own life. But then one day in 1929, Jack took a bus home. Now, this was nothing unusual. It was something he did all the time. But on this particular trip, he really saw in himself that he had to give in. He could see in his heart that he was like holding a door shut. And he realized that he had to just let go of it. He wrote later, "I needed to open, to unbuckle, to loosen the rein." And he decided to be open to the truth, wherever that led him, whether he liked it or not. He needed truth. And it was a simple decision on that bus. He decided that God was God. Now, later that night in his rooms, he actually got down on his knees and he decided that he would acknowledge that God was there. But he did this very reluctantly, as he wrote. "I gave in and admitted that God was God, and I knelt and prayed, perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England." He went on to say, "I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert on such terms." You see, for him, he thought, at least the prodigal son came back on his own 2 feet. But for him, he felt like he was being dragged in. And he was kicking and screaming and looking for a chance to escape. At this point, Jack was not completely saved. He had acknowledged that there was a God. But what about Jesus? Now, it wasn't until 2 years later. And it was a fine autumn night. And Jack was with his good friends in Oxford, that just had a meal together, and they were sitting and discussing lots of different topics. We would have recognized one of these friends if we were there. He was the renowned professor of philology, a very famous academic, but we would perhaps know him more as a writer. His name was J.R.R. Tolkien. The other friend was Hugo Dyson, another English academic. And the three of them were discussing mythology and which led to the Gospels, which led to Jesus. And Tolkien said to Lewis that, there aren't that many differences. Perhaps the Gospel is a story. But the one key difference is that this is a true story. And perhaps all those other ancient myths you're talking about, they take something from the original truth, which we see in the Gospels. And Tolkien also said to Lewis that you're prejudiced against Christianity. You're not thinking in a very rational way. You don't want to believe. And Jack Lewis had to acknowledge that his good friend Tolkien was quite right. The men talked and they walked up and down Addison's Walk into the early hours. And this was a very significant conversation for Jack. Now, a week later, Jack, Mrs. Moore, Mrs. Moore's daughter Maureen, and now Warnie, who was living with them now because he'd finished his military service, they all decided that they wanted to go to the zoo. And it was a bit of a foggy day and the women were fussing a little bit, and finally they decided that the women would take the car to the zoo and Warnie would take the motorcycle and Jack would sit in the sidecar of the motorcycle to get to the zoo. This was a bit of a sacrifice for Jack. He didn't like Warnie's driving anyway, and then being squashed into that little sidecar of a motorcycle, it wasn't his favourite thing. But he agreed. And it was there. It squashed into the sidecar of a motorcycle that God again met with Jack. In there, watching the English countryside zip by, Jack realized that he needed to make a decision about Jesus Christ. He thought through that late night conversation with his friends, Tolkien and Dyson. He thought about all the influences that had accumulated in his life over the past 2 years. And by the time they arrived at the zoo, Jack believed that Jesus was the Son of God and had committed his life to him. This wasn't an overflow of emotion. It wasn't a very emotional time for him. But he was clear. When he left home, he was a theist. He believed in God. But by the time he got to the zoo, he was a Christian. He believed in Christ. He wrote to his friend, "I've gone from believing in God to believing in Christ." And what about that joy that he had spent so much of his life in pursuit of and thinking about and wondering how to get this joy and keep it? Well, actually, he completely stopped pursuing it. As he explained, when you are lost in the woods and then you finally see a signpost, everyone gathers around and they look at it and they gaze at it and then they think about it. But when you know you're heading in the right direction already, then you don't stop at every signpost and gaze at it, because you already know you're heading in the right direction. And for Jack, he knew now the source of all that joy. And he knew he was heading right for him. And so began an incredible journey. Jack was now in his early 30s, and he began writing. He began writing Christian texts. His first was an allegory of his own conversion called A Pilgrim's Regress. And many other works followed. I mean, we know him for the Narnia series, but he wrote so much more than that. He wrote a science fiction trilogy, The Problem of Pain, Screwtape Letters, Mere Christianity, The Abolition of Man, Miracles, The Four Loves, Surprised by Joy, A Grief Observed. So many books flowed from his pen. And with so much writing, he also started a little club. It was called The Inklings. And this was a group of other writers. Other people, of course, Tolkien was part of this group. And they used to critique each other's work. They would read their new chapters to the group, and then the group would tear it to shreds because they were all writers and they were all, you know, highly qualified academics. And I could imagine it would be quite intimidating to take a new chapter and read it to this particular group. In fact, Tolkien, when he first heard about The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, he didn't like it. He said to Lewis, "You're Narnia, such a disorderly place. What sort of place has fauns and talking beavers, dwarves and witches all in the one space?" And then when Tolkien read his Hobbit stories, Lewis recognised its brilliance immediately and encouraged Tolkien to keep writing. He said, "This is lightning out of a clear sky." And actually later, Tolkien credited Lewis for getting him through The Lord of the Rings. And without his encouragement, Tolkien said, "I would have stopped many times and the world would never have seen such a book." And then Hitler rose to power, and this generation of men who'd already endured one world war was thrown into yet another. Now, during the war, Lewis's work diminished completely. I mean, students were enlisted to the war, and even teachers at the university, they went to join the war effort. And he too had to join the Home Guard. And during this war period, remember, England was quite central in the war. Lewis was actually invited to address the RAF pilots in the 1940s. These men at this point in the war were Britain's best and brightest, and the country was depending on them. And the men were terrified. These were young men, and at this point, the average number of missions you survived was about 13. And so these men really recognized their life could end. Every day they thought, is this my last? Is this my last? And Lewis was determined to address them, even though he really didn't know how this would work. The first time he did this, it went terribly. He had to learn to speak their language, and he realized that his work as a lecturer at Oxford and tutoring, you know, all these academic students and so on had not really prepared him to talk to young men of all walks of life. And so he was a fast learner. He really trained himself to use a different style of language. He thought more carefully about the illustrations he used to explain things more clearly. He really tried to get amongst these men to understand how they viewed life and what they really thought. And little did he know that this was actually preparation for the next big task that he would have. By this time, many of his works had been circulating, and particularly his book, The Problem of Pain, which looks at the idea of suffering from a Christian point of view. And if you imagine, during the war, this was a very relevant book. Reverend Welch, who was part of the religious broadcasting department of the BBC, had read the book and immediately contacted Lewis and asked him to appear on the BBC radio to give a series of 15-minute talks on Christianity and the meaning of life. It's hard for us to imagine that this would ever be, but this was such a crucial time for the British public. This was during the Battle of Britain, when Britain, London particularly, and the surrounding areas were being bombed every night by the German planes. People were dying every night. There was rubble everywhere, and every night you wondered if it would be you next. Well, Lewis agreed. He had no experience at all on the radio. He didn't really understand what he would be doing, but he was happy to do it. He would be broadcast weekly, and it would be on the Home Service Channel, which would be to the soldiers on the front line, as well as into homes and across pubs across the country. Lewis actually adapted his speaking style perfectly, and he spoke about what Christianity was all about. And this was then extended to more and more, like as because it was quite popular, each series was kind of extended. He made it very clear that he was no theologian, and he was just like an ordinary believer, somebody who had discovered Christ. Now, these broadcast talks were actually collected, and then they were published, each in their little separate volumes. But then, because of their popularity and because they really helped people, Jack put them into one volume, and he called it Mere Christianity. Now, after the war, Jack became very, very, very well known, not because of just these radio talks, but also because of another book he'd written during the war. This book was called The Screwtape Letters, and it had hit the shelves and become so popular. Now, this is a unique book. In fact, I still think it is one of the most unique Christian books ever written. It was the idea is it's a collection of fictitious letters. Letters from one devil, a senior devil, to a junior devil. And the senior devil is sharing advice on how to stop someone from becoming a Christian. And then when, unfortunately, they might become a Christian, how to stop them from growing and becoming closer to God. So it's quite a different take. Well, actually, he got this idea from, he just came up with this idea while sitting in a church service, listening to a Sunday sermon, and actually not listening to a Sunday sermon. His mind was clearly wandering. Now, the book made him famous in America. He'd never been to America, but his name became very famous there, and soon other books of his were selling. And so, pretty much overnight, he became a very well-known name. The name of C.S. Lewis became a sort of a household name. And soon he was getting all the royalties for these books, and he didn't know what to do. So immediately he set up a charity fund, and he gave this money away. In fact, he for all of his life, he had no sense of money just to give it away. He was extremely generous. Now we skip ahead to 1952, and now he's in his 50s. He was a comfortable bachelor living in a house which was called the Kilns. It's still there today. You can go and visit it. This is something that Mrs. Moore, Jack, and Warney had bought together. And they'd lived there for a while. Mrs. Moore had now passed away. Maureen, the daughter, had moved on and married. And so here it was just Jack and Warney living in this house. And Jack spent a lot of time writing letters and replying to letters because he was getting a lot of mail at this point. And one letter he received was from an American Jew by the name of Joy Davidman. She too was a writer, and she'd read some of Lewis's works. And she had a couple of questions, and she thought there were sort of, you know, problems with his argument, and so on. So she wrote, and Lewis received this letter, and he wrote back. And Joy, when she received this particular letter, was so impressed by the thoroughness and also by the explanation so clear, and she realised that, yes, you know, her arguments weren't quite right after all. Now, Joy Davidman has her own particular story, but just to give a picture and to be brief, she was a Jew, but she was brought up an atheist in America. She was a bit of a political sort of character. She joined the Communist Party, but then became quite disillusioned with communism. She then married, but her marriage was very, very turbulent. And her life sort of became very difficult. She started seeking as well. And through the help of Lewis's works, actually, she became a Christian. Now, her marriage didn't ever get any better. Her husband was unfaithful repeatedly. He was an alcoholic, and he then became extremely violent. She had two young boys at this time, and it was not safe for her to remain. Her own health was suffering, and she decided to get out of America, to go to London, where she could continue writing. She had friends there. She had contacts. She would take her boys, and she would try and set up her life there. Now, during this time, she actually wrote a letter to Lewis and asked if they could meet to converse. And she and her friends met with Lewis to have conversation. And she was very impressed by him. And, you know, she herself was an academic and a thinker. And, in fact, Lewis was impressed by her. And their two minds worked well together. Now, she met Lewis a few more times while she was in London. And then she applied to have her visa to stay. The reason she did that was because her husband, during this holiday period, had filed for a divorce and wanted to divorce her. And so she agreed to that and decided that she would stay forevermore now in England and set up her life there with her boys. But at the very last minute, her visa was rejected. And that was because it was discovered that early in her life, she was part of that Communist Party. And she didn't know what to do. She was going to be deported. Her boys didn't at all want to go back to America and be with their father again. And she didn't have any options. She didn't know what on earth she was going to do because it was just rejected. Now, during this time, Joy and Jack had become very close friends. And in fact, through the charity fund, Jack was actually supporting Joy and the two boys and were helping them settle into the country and getting them education and so on. But despite this generosity, he did something else as well. He said to Joy, "Well, I think there's one way that we can secure your stay in England." And he offered to marry her. Well, he recognized that he was actually 14 years older. And he actually said to her, "I think you really should marry someone a lot younger. But at least it would help with your visa." Well, she agreed. But they were married in a civil ceremony, just like a legal marriage, not a marriage in the church. And the reason they did this was because Jack felt that maybe she'd want to cancel the marriage afterwards. And he had the wrong understanding of what marriage was all about. And he thought there was a difference between just the legal documents of marriage and a marriage in a church. But he also had no idea how much he really did love Joy and she him. And so the two were married in 1956. And then Joy was able to stay in England, and the boys as well. Now, actually, the love between Jack and Joy blossomed after their legal marriage. And the boys, too, loved their stepfather. But then one day, not long after the marriage, Joy fell down suddenly. It was like her leg just snapped from underneath her. And they did all these scans, and they discovered that she had bone cancer, and that literally her bone had crumbled. And Jack was beside himself. And Joy went from being completely healthy to being bedridden within weeks. And just he was so shocked at this. And perhaps this crisis led him to really understand just how much he loved her. And so he decided that he needed to marry her properly, and that what he'd done before wasn't particularly right. And so he called his reverend friend, some reverend, and they had to go to the hospital, actually, and perform the wedding ceremony there. And there, with a few friends, he vowed to have and to hold in sickness and in health. They prayed there, too, for Joy's recovery, but the doctors really had no help, no hope, and there was no help for her. They actually sent her home from the hospital, saying that she would die more comfortably at home. Well, Lewis did everything to make her comfortable at the Kilns, and he continued to support the boys and said that he would provide for them for the rest of their lives. But strangely, Joy started to improve. And instead of slipping into unconsciousness, which the doctors had predicted, she actually started getting stronger. Soon she was able to sit up, and then she was able to walk around with a bit of a frame and soon a walking stick and potter around the garden. And then she was suggesting home improvements and suggesting different menus for the cooking of the meals for the household. Well, this was nothing short of a miracle, and Jack certainly believed it to be such. The doctors did more scans, and they discovered that far from deteriorating further, her bones had improved. Well, Jack, at this point, his health was going downhill. In a funny way, he thought that perhaps he had borne the burden with his wife, that he had become weaker as she had become stronger. Well, this frail couple, they loved and appreciated every moment they had together. They knew just how temporary life was, and they thanked the Lord for this little extra time that they had together. Well, it was a little time, because the cancer did return, and Joy passed away quite suddenly when it did. And again, this really shook Lewis. Again, he experienced this profound grief. But this time, he had his faith, and he understood that the Lord's hand was here, even in such pain. He wrote earlier, "We can ignore even pleasure, but pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks in our conscience, but he shouts in our pains. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." Soon after Joy's death, he wrote the book, A Grief Observed. And this is a very personal account of his journey through grief towards acceptance. In fact, when he published it, he didn't want to put his name on it because he was well known at that time. And he put another name, a random name, because it was such a personal book for him. When Joy died in 1960, they'd only been married for 4 years. And after that, Lewis's life returned to its former routine. It was just him and Warnie again in that home called the Kilns. Their father had died 2 years ago, and now even Joy's two boys were grown up. They were adults now. Lewis was continuing to receive so many letters, hundreds of letters, and he tried to make an effort of actually answering all of them if he could. And many of these letters actually came from children, because in this last 10 years of his life, from the 1950s to 60s, he'd been writing the Narnia series. Starting, the first book was The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and many books followed. The 7 books followed, or 6, I should say. During this time, he continued writing, including his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, which is his story of how he came to Christ. But his health was going downhill. He was now in his 60s. He had osteoporosis and kidney difficulties. And it was Warnie was caring for him, but now he could hardly get up the stairs in his own home. And then one evening, Jack said quietly to Warnie, "I've done all I wanted to do. I'm ready to go." And 2 days later, on Friday the 22nd of November in 1963, the brothers exchanged a few words in the morning as they usually did, and Lewis went to write letters and answer the many letters that had come for him. But he was feeling unusually tired, and he went to rest. And then at 5:30, Warnie heard a crash, and he ran to the room and found Jack lifeless on the floor. Jack, his beloved younger brother, had passed to glory. Now, with all of Jack's publications, years before, he'd been approached by his solicitor to work out what to do with the royalties of all his books after his death. "After my death?" Jack had laughed. "After my death? Well, after 5 years, no one will be reading anything I've written." Well, he was certainly no prophet, that's for sure, because the Narnia series alone has sold 100 million copies all over the world. And many of his works are still so, so popular today. And they've helped so many people, me included, to clarify the basic principles of the Christian faith in a very simple, very rational way, with a tinge of warmth and humour and imagination as well, which is quite a rare combination. Jack was by no means perfect. He struggled with fame. At times he had questionable views. He didn't always have the right view about things. Marriage is one example of that. But he was teachable, and he recognised his limitations. He wrote, "I have no claim to speak as an expert and merely put forward the reflections which have risen from my own mind, which seem to me, perhaps wrongly, to be helpful. They are all submitted to the correction of wiser heads." C.S. Lewis was yet another of God's servants who had clear gifts and used them for the glory of God. And through his life, even before he became a Christian, God was training him for this work that he was to do. Now, neither the news of his death or his funeral was marked by any huge ceremony, which is perhaps unusual considering how famous he was. And the reason for that was because on the very same day, JFK was assassinated. But of course, the fact that there was no huge ceremony for Lewis is of absolutely no consequence in the light of eternity. And we can imagine Jack Lewis now basking in the fulfillment of all joy, a joy that had pointed him to the cross of Jesus and to finally see Jesus as his Lord. So we're going to finish with a quote from The Last Battle, which, if you know your Narnia series, is the very last book of the Chronicles of Narnia. And this is his ending, which I've taken a bit of liberty with. And for us, this is the end of all stories. But for him, it was only the beginning of the real story. All his life in this world and all his adventures, which had been the cover and the title page, now at last, he was beginning chapter one of the great story, which no one on earth has read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before. And certainly, if you have not read any of Lewis's work, it is well worth reading some of his works. Certainly the Narnia series, he wrote that for children. And the reason he wrote that particular series was to prepare children to receive truths or principles in the Christian faith. So he wrote it very carefully, very thoughtfully. And it's, I appreciate it even as an adult reading it. So I'd encourage you definitely to read that. And his book, Mere Christianity, is also very, very helpful. And so do read that. Screwtape Letters, I could go on. But do read his works. They are helpful.